take part in. During the evening, there will be food, speakers, musical performances, and more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th in Portland. Information on project locations, performances, speakers, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. Time is 8:59 a.m. Coming up at 9, Progressive Spirit host John Shuck speaks with Dr. Nahida Gordon, a Palestinian-American who wrote the book Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness. Then at 9:30, we speak with Matthew Charles Cardinale, a Portland-based housing advocate, about an ordinance for affordable housing impact statements that he has presented to Multnomah County. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints. And at 11 on the Digital Divide, we hear an extended statement from Chelsea Manning, and later a talk by Medea Benjamin given at the Left Forum in New York City. The theme was rage, rebellion, and organizing our power. Speaking of organizing and of power, KBOO is powered by an organized group of volunteers and a whole lot of community supporters. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. You click where it says the word donate. And now, this.
From KBOO in Portland, Oregon, this is Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. I'm John Shuck. The Presbyterian Church USA will be meeting in Portland June 18th through the 26th. Once every 2 years, the Presbyterians have their General Assembly. Speaking to a committee of the Assembly will be Nahida Gordon, author of Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness.
There are also a lot of examples of administrative detention of children, Israeli prisons, and on this subject, I'm presenting an overture at the Presbyterian General Assembly for the safety and well-being of children. Torture and mistreatment of Palestinian children in Israeli military jails is well documented by many human rights organizations, and I hope to bring this to the General Assembly and have the church asking Israel to change its ways.
Dr. Gordon is Professor Emerita at Case Western Reserve University. Her field of study is probability and statistics. Her passion, and the reason she's speaking with me today, is advocacy for justice and peace in Palestine. She's an elder in the Presbyterian Church USA and a member of the steering committee of the Israel-Palestine Mission Network and Advocacy Committee for Racial Justice with the Presbyterian Church USA. She's the author of this newly released book, Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness, and she's with me via Skype from her home in Ohio. Welcome, Dr. Gordon, to Progressive Spirit.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my honor.
Now, you are from Palestine. You experienced firsthand the 1948 Palestinian Nakba. You were a young girl then living in Jaffa. What do you remember from that experience?
I have a lot of very vivid memories, and I have written about some of them in the book. Probably the most, besides wonderful memories of being together with family, we used to go every week to dinner with my grandmother in Jerusalem. My father would drive us from Jaffa and back. So that's part of a wonderful memory. School was wonderful as well. However, there are some painful memories, particularly trying to go to sleep at night, listening to the bombs being directed towards Jaffa by the Israeli Haganah forces. It was really quite difficult and frightening time. I also remember very vividly after a very well-known and famous bombing in the market square in Jaffa, downtown Jaffa, near where my father had his offices. He was there when the bomb went off. It was actually a truck packed with explosives and then hidden with oranges left by two Israeli terrorists. When the bomb went off, the whole municipality building came down, and the explosion was so loud that it, it blew out windows all over the square. And my father was actually in a building where part of the ceiling fell down. He saved himself by, he told us, by jumping underneath a table. He was wounded, and I have a very vivid memory of seeing him coming home just soaked with blood, my mother trying to clean him up. So there were a lot of frightening memories in Jaffa near the end there. This was in the spring of 1948.
Many people do not know what the Nakba was. Can you give a brief overview of what happened, and even as it happened with you?
The Nakba is an Arabic word which means catastrophe or, well, basically catastrophe. It's just a very brief history. Palestine, in the first part of the 20th century, had about 6 or 8% of its population were Jewish Palestinians. They had been in Palestine for many years. A lot of them spoke Arabic. They ate our food, and we were good friends. One of my best friends was a child of a Christian man and a Jewish woman. And when the British took Palestine from the Ottoman Turks during and after the First World War, they encouraged a lot of immigration of European Jews into Palestine. And the proportion of the population started to increase. The Muslims and the Christians realized right away what the British were doing, and they started complaining. The first uprising was in 1922, and one of the last uprisings ended the year I was born in 1939. It began in 1936. The British systematically disarmed the Palestinians, and during the last uprising, they are known to have either banished, executed, or imprisoned 5,000 of the leaders of the Palestinian community. So the Palestinian community was disarmed, and the Jewish community was well-armed, well-equipped, and the British did everything they could to help them build their institutions to form a homeland in Palestine. And so there were a lot of troubles then started between the Palestinians, the Jews, and the British. By 1947, things had really gotten quite bad, and England took it to the United Nations, and the General Assembly recommended partition of Palestine. Mind you, United Nations does not have the right to partition any country, and General Assembly resolutions were only recommendations. They were not law. Actually, even the Security Council doesn't have a right to partition a country. And at the same time, the Security Council was discussing Palestine, and they were thinking of forming a trusteeship under the United States. But while that was going on, this was into April. By May 15, Israel declared itself a country, and the Truman administration, almost within 6 minutes, recognized Israel. And that gave it instant legitimacy. Now, between 47 and May 15, before any Arab forces came into Palestine to protect the Muslim and Christian populace, the Israelis began a campaign of ethnic cleansing. These are very well documented in many, many books, also written by many Israelis as well as Palestinians. As many as 750,000 Palestinians were expelled from Palestine, and over 500 villages were destroyed. By 1949, there was an armistice signed that drew the boundaries that you see today, the West Bank and Gaza. The West Bank was with Jordan, Gaza was with Egypt, and the rest of Palestine, 78% was with Israel. So basically, the Nakba in 1948 was the loss of our homeland and our communities.
Now, it's been nearly 70 years. The goal of Israeli leaders is for Palestinians and the rest of the world to forget what happened, to erase the memory and the history of the Palestinian people. To what extent have the Israelis succeeded and have not succeeded in erasing Palestinian memory?
I don't think they've succeeded. They're trying very hard. They're changing the names of roads. They're changing some of the signage. In some places, there's absolutely no Arabic. Some English and Hebrew. The Palestinians still have their culture, and my book, Palestine is Our Home, is an attempt to show people in the West that the Palestinian culture is alive and vibrant. We are still a community. We are building. We hope for the future, and a lot of us hope for the right of return. So I don't think they're succeeding. Our memory is long, and we still hope for the future.
Explain the right of return.
The right of return is an individual right granted under international law. If you, for one reason or another, decide that you must leave your homeland, you have the right to return for whatever reason, health reasons, war, or whatever. You always have a right to return to your homeland. Now, you know, there have been many wars where their population movements back and forth, but they've been allowed to return if they so choose. This is different in the case of Israel. They are not allowing Palestinians to return. Soon after the creation of Israel, a lot of Palestinians attempted to return, and the Israeli government called them infiltrators, and they were shot on sight. So our right of return is our personal right, and it cannot be mandated or negotiated away by governments. It's a personal right that we have a right to go back to our home. Now, the Israelis have a law for right of return as well. They claim that any Jew anywhere in the world has a right to go to Israel as long as they're well-behaved people and they're not criminals and so forth, and be citizens in Israel. We Palestinians who trace our ancestry for centuries back in Palestine are not granted this right by Israel.
One of the symbols of that right is the key, keys to homes.
Yes. Actually, I have 6 keys from my home, 5 keys from the home, and 1 from my father's business, whose office was in downtown Jaffa. You know, when you think about it personally, let's say you decide to go on a vacation. You think you'll be gone for a week. You tidy up your house. You turn off the stove. You turn off the lights. And the last thing you do is you lock the door and put the key in your pocket, and you go on your vacation expecting to come back. Now, many Palestinians really thought, well, we'll leave for safety. In my case, the Israelis were bombing the civilian areas of Jaffa, and the church across the street lost part of its roof from one of those bombings. And my father thought this was too dangerous for us. So he said, well, let's just leave for a few weeks. When things calm down, we can return. Well, they didn't let us return. So many, many people have keys. They even have keys to homes and doors that don't exist anymore. In my case, the front door to our house is still there. I'd rather doubt that the key works, but that's why the key is a symbol of the right of return. There are many keys with people still. They pass it on from generation to generation. When I pass away, I intend to pass my 6 keys to my children.
If you are just joining us on Progressive Spirit, my guest is Dr. Nahida Gordon. She's the author of Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Lost Courage and Steadfastness, the editor of this work, in which you include a number of voices. I want to talk about one of them with you. In the narrative by Machida Akram-Fida, she was arrested and detained for running in an election. Can you talk about her story and the practice of arrest and detention?
Yes, Majda was running on a list in Nablus for the municipal seat, and she won. Several months later, I think 6 months to a year later, the Israelis declared the list on which she ran to be illegal, and so they decided to arrest her. And they arrested her on what is called administrative detention. This they can renew every 6 months. They don't have to try you. They can do it without a lawyer and so forth. And in her case, it was renewed 4 times, and she spent a little bit over 2 years in prison. The narrative in there tells about how she felt, what it was like in prison. One time she told she was going to be released, and she gave away all her belongings in prison and was all excited about rejoining her parents. And then the next morning when she was to be released, half an hour before, she found out that she was going to go through another cycle of administrative detention. And it's a very poignant story. There are also a lot of examples of administrative detention of children in Israeli prisons. And on this subject, I'm presenting an overture at the Presbyterian General Assembly for the safety and well-being of children. Torture and mistreatment of Palestinian children in Israeli military jails is well documented by many human rights organizations. And I hope to bring this to the General Assembly and have the church asking Israel to change its ways.
Now, you are a member of the Presbyterian Church USA. The denomination is meeting in Portland this week. At the last General Assembly in 2014, the church divested from Caterpillar, Motorola, and Hewlett-Packard for non-peaceful activities in regards to the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And you're bringing up an overture about children and human rights. What's the significance for Palestinians of the American church to take on these kinds of actions?
They are very much behind this. You may have seen the wall separating Bethlehem from Jerusalem and the other environs. Before the General Assembly in 2014, there was a huge drawing on the wall saying, "Presbyterians, please divest." Now, a lot of the Israeli propaganda was saying, well, if you divest or you boycott, you're just hurting Palestinians. Palestinians understand that boycotting and divesting from Israeli companies that profit from the occupation is a good nonviolent means for making change. They've seen this happen historically, particularly in South Africa, and they are hoping that this would be one means for making change in the government of Israel and its actions in the West Bank. So they are very much for it and applaud the Presbyterians for doing this.
Now, someone said to me recently, and you wrote it also in your book, it's been said to you, that the Palestinians need a Gandhi or a Martin Luther King, often heard. But this BDS movement is exactly that, isn't it? A nonviolent movement. And that itself is a threat to Israelis.
It really shouldn't be, but they feel that it is. The BDS call by the civil society and the Christian church churches in Palestine basically is asking for three things. And all three things have been also passed by the Presbyterian Church and by the United Nations. One of them is mistreatment of Palestinians living in Israel. There are many laws that discriminate against Palestinians living in Israel. So they want equal human rights for Palestinians in Israel. They want an end of the occupation. This is, again, something the Presbyterians have called for over and over again, and the right of return or compensation for those who do not wish to return. And again, the Presbyterian Church has repeatedly stated that it backs the right of return, particularly in the 2010 report of the Middle East Study Committee, and it has all these three things in it.
Dr. Nahida Gordon, my guest on Progressive Spirit. She's the editor of Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness. You write that the church's voices have been blunted because, and I'm quoting you, they fell into the trap of addressing the conflict as one between two equal parties and not as one between an occupier and the occupied, end quote. So that aspect, and I often hear that people say, well, you know, they've been fighting over there forever. And neither of those things are true, that it's equal parties or that Palestinians and Jews have been fighting forever.
That's true, particularly the second point you raised. My memory when I was a child in Palestine is that for the most part, Jews, Christians, and Muslims got along together quite well. What the problem was is not the Jewish people. The Israeli government decided that they wanted a home for the Jews. They wanted this without any Palestinians. And the partition plan, by the way, that was proposed gave the Jewish population 55% of the land, even though they were 30%. And they gave 45% to the Palestinians, who were more than two-thirds of the population. And moreover, in the part they were to give to the Palestinians, only 1% were Jews. And in the part that they were to give to the Israelis, as much as 50% were Christians and Muslims. So the people running the Israeli government did not like that high proportion of Palestinians in the part that they wished for themselves. So that's why the ethnic cleansing began. So the problems began with the high immigration of basically foreigners, people from the West who came into Palestine. And the fighting was not for centuries past. As a matter of fact, if you look at the history of the Crusades, there are instances where the Jews of Palestine helped the Muslims against the Crusaders. So, you know, history is very rich and complicated, and it's not simple, as the Israelis would have you believe, that they've always been fighting. That is just not true. And the other issue, the first one that you bring up, that this is a fight amongst equals is so totally wrong. Israel receives over $3 billion worth of armaments from the United States a year. The Palestinians are totally disarmed. They don't have guns. A few of them may be able to buy some guns, actually, from Israelis. They have knives, and they have mostly stones. But the majority of Palestinians feel that if they just continue to exist on their land, that is a form of resistance. There's a huge graffiti on the wall just as you leave Bethlehem that says, to exist is to resist. And I have that in the book as well. It's a beautiful full-color graffiti. So they feel that they know now not to run away when the Israelis come and terrorize them. They want to stay on their land. They want to prosper and persist. They have a word for this in Arabic called sumud. They believe that through sumud and through centuries, they will overcome their troubles and Palestine will still be their homeland. Whether it's called Palestine or Israel doesn't make any difference, but that's their homeland. The Holy Land is their homeland.
I know a paper that is being presented to the Presbyterian Church General Assembly, of which you are speaking this week, makes the case for changing the church's longtime stance for a two-state solution to a solution based on human rights for all people. Is this the kind of change in the conversation that is needed by American churches?
Yes, actually, the decision for a one-state, this is my personal opinion, the decision for a one-state or a two-state is really up to the Israelis and the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. In fact, it already is a one-state, and I think it's an apartheid state. In the West Bank, there is military law for the Palestinians, and there is civil law for the Israelis. And within Israel proper, there are, I'm told, as many as 50 laws discriminating against Palestinians. The issue is human rights, and it's not up to the Presbyterians to decide whether it should be one or two states. And I think A.C. Schwab has taken the correct stance on the study of one state versus two states, and that we should work for human rights. This is really not any different than the previous stances of the Presbyterian Church. When they upheld the right of return, they upheld the right of to end occupation and so forth. I think it's an excellent statement. There are a few things in it I didn't quite agree with, points of fact, but on the whole, concentrating on human rights is the way to go, both for Israeli citizens and as well for Palestinian citizens, both of them.
Nahida Gordon, editor of Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness, my guest on Progressive Spirit. I recently spoke with a young Muslim woman on this program. She's a college student in Portland, and her parents lived in Gaza, and she visited her grandparents there just after the attack on Gaza in 2014. And she said that despite that war, the people are strong. That's what she said. That's the word that describes them most, strength. Now, the subtitle of your book is Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness. So personally for you, do you see a path for justice and return? Do you see the hope of strength for Palestinians?
Yes. Again, the word samud that we like to use, and that means perseverance. We are strong in the sense that we now understand and know that we are not to run away from the Israelis. We are to stay on our land and persevere. And we think that in the long run, we will overcome. We all have a hope that the world will know what is going on and hear our voices. That's why I wrote this book. And I wanted actual voices of real people and their real experiences to be heard by the American public. And I really think that if the American public really understood the Palestinians, what they had gone through, and understand their culture and so forth, there will be a groundswell influencing our government to stop supporting Israel's impunity against the Palestinians. We have hope, and we are strong, and we're not going to give up, and we're not going to go away.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your book and some of those voices? Did one voice come to mind for you that you'd like to highlight here?
Well, the one I think I like the most in some ways is Gabby Baramke, who was the second in command at Brzeit University during the 70s and the 60s and the 70s when Israel was closing the universities. There you really see the Palestinian spirit to overcome the occupation. they would close the university for months on end, and the faculty and administrators would organize classes in homes and garages and so forth, and so that students would continue to learn. The Israelis would go around trying to find these classes, and they called them cells of illegal education, which is sort of a ridiculous term. They didn't have a law against it, so they created this word. We are going after cells of illegal education, and we will not stop. So you see the battle back and forth between the university and the faculty and the students and what the Israelis were doing to them. And you see this Palestinian spirit to overcome all hardships. Palestinians value education a great deal, and I think that through education is one way that they can overcome what is happening to them.
I have one more question back to the BDS or Boycott, Divest, Sanctions movement. Dismantling the wall, full equality for Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel and the right of return for Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. What is the state of the BDS movement today?
Well, I think in the last, 10 years, it has come a long way. There are, besides the BDS movement, there's also the boycotting of academic institutions in Israel. They are both increasing. To me, one evidence that they are really having an effect on Israel is the fact that they have now a minister in charge of fighting BDS in the United States. And we have many state houses trying to pass legislation against the BDS movement, saying that if you support BDS, then you can't do business with the state government and so forth, which is probably illegal under our First Amendment rights. There are many companies that have withdrawn, for example, Viola, which was responsible for constructing a railway, a light railway to Jerusalem for them settlements, finally pulled out of Israel. It's having its effect. We have a long way to go. But we all believe that eventually it will have a sufficient effect that Israel hopefully change their minds in the way they work and mistreat the Palestinians.
My guest on Progressive Spirit has been Dr. Nahida Gordon. She's the editor of Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Lost Courage and Steadfastness. She's an elder in the Presbyterian Church and will be speaking at the Presbyterian General Assembly as it meets in Portland June 19th through the 26th. A final word.
I hope that people would be interested enough to purchase the book. I would like to say that once I make my expenses, all profits are going to go to Rav Dat Zuhur. This is an elementary school in East Jerusalem, which has children who cannot afford to go to private school. It does not teach Islam or Christianity. It just teaches good moral behavior. It's a beautiful little school. They are under a great deal of financial pressure, and I'm hoping that the sales of the book will help this little school prosper and survive. And I want to say again that if you really want to know how the Palestinians feel and think and meet them as people, not through the eyes of the media, read this book and look at these stories and think about Palestinians.
Dr. Nahida Gordon has been my guest on Progressive Spirit, editor of Palestine is Our Home, Voices of Loss, Courage, and Steadfastness. It's a book with a discussion and a leader's guide to offer awakening about the Palestinian situation. Thank you so much, Dr. Gordon, for this book and for being with me today.
Thank you. I appreciate it very much.
You've been listening to Progressive Spirit, progressivespirit.net. From KBOO in Portland, I'm John Shuck. Be well.
Don't give me a fraction and call it solution.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th, to take place in locations all over Portland. The Village Building Convergence is an annual celebration of placemaking, community, natural building, music, and art. During the daytime, there will be 35 natural building and public arts projects to take part in. During the evening, there will be food, speakers, musical performances, and more. Again, that's the 16th Annual Village Building Convergence, June 3rd to June 12th, in Portland. Information on project locations, performances, speakers, and more can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
There has been in the past and continues to be a strange correspondence between Christians and church traditions that hold a high view of the Bible and at the same time a very careless approach to ecological responsibility.
Patricia Tull, author of Inhabiting Eden, Christians, the Bible, and the Ecological Crisis, next on Progressive Spirit. Listen to weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/progressive spirit.
They paid paradise and put up a fucking lie.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. My guest is Matthew Charles Cardinale, who joins us by phone. Welcome, Matthew.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
And let me tell people that Matthew Charles Cardinale is a Portland-based housing advocate who presented the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners with a draft ordinance for affordable housing impact statements at their board meeting last month. And he has a history of working on housing and working on affordable housing impact statements. Matthew, can you give us a little bit more about your background, especially as how it relates to the issue of affordable housing?
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I've actually been working on affordable housing issues and homelessness issues really for about 20 years, going back to when I was a teenager, and I'll be turning 35 next week. I did in my 20s, I did such things as, organized protests to save specific trailer parks and the like, and have been moving into a direction of understanding housing as a public policy issue. And I'm currently a law student. I'm actually going to be a visiting student at Lewis and Clark in the fall. I'm a third-year student. And I created this model ordinance called Affordable Housing Impact Statements to address some of the issues that I've been seeing being a recurring issue. And I actually lived in Atlanta for several years. And one of the catalysts for this was we were seeing a pattern of funding, scarce federal funding and other funding for affordable housing units being used in such a way that they're not actually helping us meet our greatest unmet need, which is to house families making $15,000 and less per year, or even $10,000 and less per year. And if you define affordability in a way that is like 80% of the area median income, then you know, you can say, oh, look at all the units that we're producing, but they're not actually getting us anywhere, because those people do have other options on the market, although fewer and fewer. It's getting that ridiculous. But the impact statements was really a way to understand any public policy decision made by city or county, what is the benefit, what is the harm, and to really bring it back to our housing stock, because every jurisdiction has a housing stock, and every jurisdiction has a citizenry and a population, and but that has incomes, and then you have a mismatch between the two. So every jurisdiction has an unmet need that can be quantified, and this impact statement says every time we're going to use county dollars, city dollars, make a zoning change, make a land use change, make a policy change. One thing Multnomah County's been doing is taking their surplus property and allocating it to nonprofits to use for affordable housing. I just read in the Oregonian this morning, if you saw the Oregonian, they're looking at, City of Portland is looking at infill changes to try to allow some kind of medium-sized housing in single-family areas. So all these things that we're doing, let's understand what the benefit is in a quantified way, because at the bottom, you know, at the end of the day, we have an unmet need that we need to fill.
Right. And you've kind of answered this question, but maybe I'll just ask it straight out so that we have a clear understanding of what an affordable housing impact statement is.
Yes. Well, many of your listeners will be familiar with this impact statement process in the context of environmental impact statements, and really came out of NEPA, the National Environment Policy Act of 1970, which required that any decisions that would have an impact on the environment would have to have a statement. And so there's a very complicated process of, you know, preparing these statements in a public engagement process that I should say is only as good as there are advocates willing to use the process. And with affordable housing impact statements, it's really the same idea, that there would be a statement that would be produced, and it would say how many housing units would be added or subtracted from our housing stock as a result of the decision. So if it's a land use change that that we expect will lead to a demolition of something affordable, then we need a statement that says how many units are going to be lost, and then the units that are coming, are they going to be market rate? What are, you know, because a lot of the focus on dealing with our affordable housing challenge has been on trying to keep up with demand by building new things, and in reality, we actually have a large affordable housing stock that we need to hold on to every unit that we have. So, you know, we need to keep track of every addition, every subtraction. And that's what this is really about.
Mm-hmm. We do have a caller, and I'm going to put that caller on the air in just 1 minute. I did want to also clarify something else that you referred to in your first statement.
Okay.
Do you clarify for me what is your standard of what qualifies as affordable?
That's a great question. So there are basically income brackets that are centered around the median income. And, you know, in Portland, you know, if you're talking about somebody making $15,000 or less per year, that's often described as 30% of the area median income, or you'll hear 30% AMI. There has been a tendency to kind of move up the echelon of affordability towards 50% AMI, 80% AMI. Now, Multnomah County just did a good thing. They just passed $3.3 million that we expect will go towards either 50% AMI or 30, and they're targeting at-risk of homelessness. But if we define affordability such that it's almost at the median or sometimes over the median, then the people who are benefiting from those subsidies or those initiatives are people making maybe $35,000. That would be around 80% of the AMI. It's getting to the point where those people need help too, but that's not where the greatest unmet need is. I mean, these aren't the people who are about to have a heart attack because they don't know how to pay their rent. And, so we want to make sure CDBG is very scarce. That's, a city source of funding, the Community Development Block Grant, and Congress has been cutting it. So I understand why jurisdictions want to say, oh, well, we want to produce as many units as possible, and if we define affordability this way, we can say, oh, look at how many units we produced, and there was such a small amount of subsidy per unit. But it's actually not helping, helping us meet the great unmet need that we have in Multnomah County.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have tens of thousands. I mean, I don't know if people really understand that we have tens of thousands of families in Multnomah County subsisting at $10,000 and less per year.
And where are they housed now?
They are, they are either homeless or they are housing cost burdened, which means they're paying more money than they should pay toward housing, or they're in our remaining neighborhoods that have affordable housing, market rate affordable housing. But, with the gentrification that's going on, we need to be concerned about losing that too. So as development occurs in neighborhoods, we need to be very proactive about making sure that that people can stay in their neighborhoods, and that people have other options that are coming, that are being included in the new development. Whatever the answer is, whatever a community wants to do as a solution to this problem, the Affordable Housing Impact Statement is a way to really just say, well, okay, if we do this, how many units are we getting and at what income brackets? And why do we believe that? So we can compare, well, if we do A, we're going to get this. If we do B, we're only going to get this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way to have a conversation. It's a way to say, because decision makers love to say how much they care about affordable housing, but let's make sure they understand the consequences of their decisions at the time that they're making them.
I'm speaking with Matthew Charles Cardinale. We're talking about affordable housing impact statements and his proposing of them in various localities, including the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. I mentioned that we had a caller, but that caller did not want to go on the air. Their question, though, I think Sam, who's on the board, may be able to articulate it better than I. Sam, do you want to give us that question?
Sure. Good morning, Matthew. Thank you for joining us today. The caller wanted to know, with planning laws and zoning and the policies at the metro level, how does your proposal differ from and or fit in among those the existing legislation and policies and regulations?
Yeah, well, basically, I mean, we have zoning and land use at many levels, and the Affordable Housing Impact Statements can help us understand the impact of zoning and land use changes, as well as there's been some conversation about proposals that come in administratively, because a lot of the changes may not involve a land use change. It may be a building permit or some kind of something that is approved administratively. We want to cover that too. And so what we've been looking at is, okay, city issues are more about multifamily and also some single family. The Multnomah County, though, they still have some unincorporated areas where there's more rural issues, more rural zones, and there's different kinds of issues, but I still think we should be keeping track of that, because if you allow development, there can be an indirect effect where the cost of surrounding properties go up. And not so much for Multnomah, perhaps, but for other counties, you have a history of something called exclusionary zoning, which is where you have lot size requirements, acreage requirements, setback requirements that make it hard for someone who maybe could only afford something much smaller to live outside of our urban areas. So I think that there could be really, used for this at every level of government, and then even if we bring in other counties in the metro area, that would be fabulous. And we're all, there's even efforts where people are working together. So with the county, Multnomah County right now, working with the city of Portland and the city of Gresham, there's even some overlap, of some things. So the more that there can be use of this by multiple jurisdictions, we can understand, if Multnomah County adopts something, $3 million was just adopted for affordable housing, some of that may end up benefiting the city of Portland. Some of it may end up benefiting outside the city of Portland. So it's kind of like, the Multnomah County is giving a little gift to Portland and probably vice versa. So there's probably some intergovernmental benefits that we could have.
What was the reaction of the commissioners when you proposed this? What are they doing about it?
Well, I have used the public comment process at Multnomah County, which is, a 3-minute general comment, and I've been laying this out in probably about 8 or 9 3-minute comments. In addition, I've been meeting with a couple individuals in Chair Kafori's staff, and they've been fabulous. They've been interested. They've been doing their own research. And so that's been great. Also, there's been conversation with Commissioner Nick Fish in the city of Portland. That's been going on for some time. I presented my proposal to Multnomah County kind of to coincide with the recent publication of an article in the Stanford Social Innovation Review. I was like, let's strike while the iron's hot. And I was like, if you think this is a good idea, this is an actual and actionable format for you to look at. And of course, public comment, they usually don't respond to public comment, but I've been getting some encouraging comments here and there, and I think they've been very receptive, very welcoming. People should really know that some of the wonderful citizen involvement opportunities that are available in Multnomah County.
And talk about the places where affordable housing impact statements have been developed. You say that the cities of Austin and San Diego have had an affordable housing impact statement policy for several years. What has happened there? How has that worked for them?
Yes, so they've had a couple different versions, and I researched those as I put together the model bill. What makes the model bill unique is kind of that quantitative scorecard that we talked about that brings it back to numbers of units in the housing stock. Austin's is a little bit interesting because they have a county manager with veto power, and so if the county manager doesn't like what the impact statement reveals, they can actually veto things, which is pretty remarkable. But I actually spoke with someone in their administration, and what basically they're saying is that even though it's just information, it's just kind of a procedural piece, it nudges and incentivizes the proponents of these proposals, whether it's a legislator or a developer, to come up with better proposals because they know that people are going to be looking at this issue. So they really feel that even though it's just process, there are substantive benefits. And the other cities, I'm actually flying out to New Orleans next week. The city council approved a motion for their planning department to study this, and I will be meeting with their planning department. Also, Dr. DeWanda Farmer, who's on our board of directors, one of the nation's few PhDs in community development, will also be coming out there. And Los Angeles, I just learned, also has a pending motion from Councilman Paul Koretz. And then Albany, New York, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania are two other cities where the legislation is pending. So this all kind of took off really quickly. And what I did was I co-founded a nonprofit entity that I would like to share with your listeners. And that is, we're calling it Smart Alec. And many of your listeners may know about ALEC, which was the American Legislative Exchange Council, a right-wing Koch brothers corporate-funded entity that creates model legislation for that gets picked up in right-wing legislatures. So voter ID, drug testing of food stamp recipients, privatization of prisons and schools, all came out of ALEC. And with the really rapid success of this housing ordinance that I did, I kind of said, well, this is kind of like a progressive ALEC, and wouldn't it be funny if I called it Smart ALEC? So Smart ALEC is a nonprofit in the state of Oregon. We are we have bylaws. We are a real entity. It's smartalec.org, and we're actually looking to have a presence at the state capitol next year, and we want to kind of take back lobbying as a positive word, and lobby for not only affordable housing, but also environmental issues, and really try to do this thing that, you know, ALEC has been doing so successfully, which is, you know, come up with model ordinances and other types of bills for replication. And frankly, the urgency of our housing issues, the urgency of our environmental challenges, I think require that we do this. I mean, it's great to continue to experiment, and cities are experimenting, and that's great. But let's not experiment forever. Let's take some of the best stuff and you know, what is that? Control V, Control C, you know, copy and paste.
Right, and I wanted to ask you just a question about how many of us that live in the city of Portland are experiencing the building of housing all around us in our communities, say in the community or around KBOO here. I mean, we see it go up. We don't have very much seemingly to do with it. It just seems to be controlled by the developers. How would this kind of ordinance impact that massive boom that we're seeing?
Yes. Well, it is number one, a conversation tool. It's a tool to bring the impact and the bottom line into every conversation. So Portland is very fortunate to have a lot of great advocacy groups and people who are very fired up about this issue. And when various policies come up, so, I mean, you're talking about building going up, some of those are land use. Some of those have to be approved, you know, by a governmental body. And people should be showing up and saying, well, this impact statement says if you approve this, you know, there will be a negative impact, so don't approve it. The city of Portland is considering inclusionary zoning and a number of other things. Of course, the legislature just created some enabling legislation for that, and there's going to have to be some conversation of exactly how that looks. All kinds of proposals that are going, you know, people are kind of like grasping for whatever they can grasp, and it's a good thing because people understand that this is an emergency. But let's understand the comparative benefits of all of these proposals in a consistent way. And if we do care, then this gives us a way to propose whatever it is that we think, and maybe it's rent control. People are fired up about rent control. I was actually there the day that they went down to Multnomah County, and arguably that would be one of the most effective things that we could do to stabilize the cost of housing. So you know, there's that. And this is not, like, again, an informational tool. The other benefit of it is it creates a long-term tool for us to hold our elected officials accountable. Okay, well, you're running for election, re-election, and, you know, you're saying all these platitudes, but according to the impact statement binder, which is kept in the clerk's office, you made the following 12 decisions that were harmful, despite the fact that we advised you that they would be. So it is an accountability tool, and that's really the other benefit of it, is that it will allow us to really have a conversation around election time.
What are your next steps with this?
Well, so with Smart Aleck, that's smartaleck.org, and our SMART actually stands for State and Municipal Action for Results Today. So the Facebook is facebook.com, state.municipal.action, and that's because some dude took Smart Aleck. So that's the Facebook. We would love for people to, sign up for that kind of stuff. I guess what I should say is, if someone would be interested in doing that, they could go to our website. They could join our Facebook. But we want to build a national board of directors and a national membership. We want low-income participation. We actually have a mandate for diversity. And low-income participation, at least one-third of our members. And we're very serious about that. And we want people who care so much about affordable housing and the environment to be part of coming up with the next model ordinance. So affordable housing impact statements is the first, and what will be the next? We want your help in having that conversation, and we want really ordinary people to take back their city councils and county commissions, and we have again, I'm not encouraging anything, but we do happen to have a GoFundMe. We're trying to raise $100,000 to support getting this adopted in 10 cities, and we would love to just have like a bus that we could take people to Salem when they debate things that might be coming up around housing, including no-cause evictions, which might be an issue that comes up. So I think there's a lot of things, a lot of public policy debates that if people just understood the where do they need to show up and when and what's really at stake, I think people might channel some of that energy into some meaningful change.
And again, for how to contact you, how to connect with your group, Smart Aleck, or these movements to get ordinances for affordable housing impact statements?
Yeah, so it's kind of all going through the nonprofit. So that's smartaleck.org, and the Aleck is A-L-E-C, smartaleck.org. And the Facebook is a Smart Aleck on Facebook, but the literal, we literally had to get facebook.com/state.municipal.action. And between those two, people can definitely help us as we go up against Goliath.
Okay. We have 30 seconds. Anything you want to add, Matthew?
Oh, well, just... you know, it's been a pleasure coming on, and I happened to move here 6 months ago, and I'm going to just continue to be reaching out to you. I have a list of affordable housing advocates, so if you haven't heard from me, please don't be offended, and you'll probably hear from me soon.
Okay. Well, Matthew Charles Cardinale, thanks for coming on and talking about this on KBOO.
Oh, thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
And again, Matthew Charles Cardinale is a Portland-based housing advocate who presented the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners with a draft ordinance for affordable housing impact statements. This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO Public Affairs. Stay tuned for Air Cascadia with Chris Andre coming right up.